In the early 1960s, Leon Fleischer was at the height of his career as a brilliant classical concert pianist. A child prodigy, at the age of 9, Fleischer was the youngest student ever accepted to study under the great pianist Arthur Schnabel. Here is Leon Fleischer performing with the Cleveland Orchestra in 1961. This is Beethoven's Concerto for Piano and Orchestra, No. 5 in E-flat major. Less than 10 years after this performance, Leon Fleischer's right hand could barely sign his name. An undiagnosed injury caused him to lose control of the fingers of his right hand and eventually forced him to retreat from the concert stage. He adapted by moving into teaching, conducting, and playing the left-handed repertoire. Over the last 30 years, Fleischer has tried many therapies, both conventional and alternative. Since last year, he's experimented with the massage technique known as Rolfing and has benefited so much that earlier this month he performed with both hands at Carnegie Hall. Back in the 60s, when Fleischer's injury first started to give him trouble, one critic wrote that his right hand didn't seem to know what his left hand was doing. I asked him if this is how it felt to him.
In a certain sense, I think in another sense, my left hand knew all too well what my right hand was not able to do, in that my muscles in my right hand were kind of behaving on their own, not according to my will, not according to my intentions for them, which is a kind of, you know, fancy way of saying my fingers would begin in my right hand, starting with the fifth finger, with the pinky, to curl under in almost a defensive manner. They would not allow themselves to be straightened out so that I could use them in the manner that I'd used them all my life.
Well, doctors at the time seemed to have no clue about what was wrong with your hand. Did they suggest it might be psychosomatic?
Of course they did, which is really helpful for me, you know. I guess I have a bone or several bones or a whole skeleton worth of bones to pick with Western medicine. Obviously, they do wonderful and marvelous things, and particularly, I think, when it comes to some of the virtuoso surgeons around and transplantation, stuff like that. But they are certainly this syndrome, which comes, I think, under the main heading of torsion dystonia. Torsion being the twisting power of the arm, and dystonia meaning an imbalance, dystonic. It's a wonderful name and really kind of describes the syndrome well, but they haven't the vaguest of how to prevent it, or actually what it is.
Well, it's interesting to take us way back, that the 19th century was plagued by pianists' cramp, and your injury seems to have real historic precedence.
Oh, I think so. I think so. And there's reason, I think, for it, especially in relation to 20th century pianos and concert halls and orchestras and recordings. Everything, in a sense, tends to underline the possibility, to increase the possibility of getting pianist's cramp or typist's cramp or all the you know, the colloquial names for it. The halls are bigger. The orchestras are bigger and better. If you look inside a concert piano, it sounds strange to say, but if up where the right hand plays, if you look inside, the strings are very short. And if you look down where the left hand plays, the strings are very long. So it's easier to get a big sound with your left hand than with your right hand. But the right hand usually, almost always, carries the tune, so to speak. So you have to work a little bit harder with your right hand than with your left hand. So if anything gets strained, it's invariably the right hand.
Well, you've also noted that you came of age at the dawn of the modern recording industry, when for the first time the new technology enabled musicians to splice together studio performances, literally note by note. So when you sat down to perform a concert, is that what you felt you were up against in the minds and the ears of your audience, the technical perfection of recordings?
That certainly, I think without a doubt, has had an influence not only on me, but today even influences our younger artists. There is this idealized version that has usually been patched together, and the standard that sets is at one and the same time admirable, but it is also very destructive, in the sense that people are human, they can make mistakes, and it also emphasizes, I think, for our young artists, the wrong aspect of creativity. It emphasizes, it teaches them to try and go for a kind of physical or technical perfection over the risks that must be taken if you want to bring a work of art to life and take the chance that you'll play a clinker or two or several clinkers. That's if the spirit of the music is being communicated, it's terribly interesting. Clinkers become very unimportant to the listener.
In the 60s, though, your response to your gradual loss of control over your right hand was to keep on practicing more and more and more.
Yeah.
Did you finally have one epiphany, one moment in which you realized you just could not play as well enough to meet your own standards?
Over several concerts, I became aware that I was losing this very fine control and ability to be as precise as I felt I needed to be. As I say, it took a period of about 10 months of gradual increase in difficulty before I realized I just couldn't play anymore, and I had to give up. I had to stop playing.
You canceled your scheduled performances, and for a period of 2 years, you battled depression. What form did that depression take?
Oh, you really want all the nitty-gritty, you know. Depression takes many forms. Suicide was certainly one that was present in my mind, underlying a lot of my feelings, because I felt that my life was over. If I couldn't make music, there really didn't seem to be that much reason to stay alive. Growing hair long enough to be worn in a ponytail was one of the results of that depression. Getting a Vespa and tooling around town as fast as I could, you know, tempting centrifugal force on sharp corners and things like that. There, you know, no end of manifestations of a deep, deep funk.
What brought you out of it?
I guess the realization, two things. One day, the realization that music did, for me, music didn't depend exclusively on the ability to play it with two hands. There were other ways of being a musician. There was a literature for one hand. A former student of mine, who for the past almost 30 years has been a co-director of a group that we have in Washington called the Theater Chamber Players of Kennedy Center. Dina Kosten is her name. She was a student of mine, and she's also a composer, and she had this idea to start a chamber ensemble group devoted to showing the connections between old and new music. She had this idea, and she asked me, you know, why don't we start this group, and you can conduct those pieces that need conducting. So here seemed, you know, to be an outlet for my need to remain connected with music. I increased my teaching. And when I first started to learn left-hand repertoire was, I guess, the large step. It was at one and the same time an admission that I couldn't use my right hand. Let's get on with it and let's see what the music is like that I could play with my left hand.
Let's play one of your recordings of piano works for the left hand. This is the Blumenfeld Etude in A flat major. Pianist and conductor Leon Fleischer is my guest. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is pianist Leon Fleischer. Tell us about the left-handed repertoire. How mm-hmm. long a tradition does it have?
Well, it's interesting. The repertoire that exists for piano and orchestra is almost exclusively thanks to one Paul Wittgenstein, who was an Austrian concert pianist. From a very well-to-do family. His home in Vienna was a Sunday night haven for people like Brahms, who would come over and make chamber music and other composers of the time. Wittgenstein was a soldier in World War I and unfortunately had his right arm shot off. But he was so committed, I think I know what that feeling is, to continuing to make music, that he used his personal fortune to commission works for left hand and orchestra from the great composers of the day, such as Maurice Ravel, Benjamin Britten, Richard Strauss. There's some, I guess, between 20, 30 concertos that are written for left hand and orchestra. The solo repertoire actually dates back, as far as I can tell, to the 18th century. And this always seemed to be a challenge for composers. Brahms wrote a transcription of the famous Bach Chaconne for violin. He wrote a left-hand version of that for Clara Schumann. She had hurt her right hand, and he wanted to give her something to occupy her while that injury was recuperating.
If you can excuse a naive question, is the intention to make the music sound as if you are using both hands?
Isn't that a good question? Actually, that was the express and stated intention of Maurice Ravel, who I think... according to any value judgment system in quality of music, probably wrote the greatest work ever written for left hand and orchestra, Ravel's left hand concerto. And he wrote that his intention, his hope with that piece was that if one were to listen to it in the concert hall with one's eyes closed, nothing out of the ordinary would be perceptible. In other words, that it would sound like two hands going. And that's precisely, you know, being the genius that he was, that's precisely the effect that he achieved. For other composers, such as Prokofiev or Benjamin Britten, they've taken another tack. They have not tried to sound like two hands. They've made the left hand as though it were another instrument in the orchestra, an almost exclusively horizontal line, rather than Ravel's tack, which was to make it not only sound horizontal, but vertical at the same time.
And what do you mean by that, sounding horizontal as opposed to vertical?
Well, music passes in time. Therefore, that is a horizontal experience. If you have one voice, let's say an oboe or a violin or whatever the instrument is, they can usually, certainly the wind instruments, basically can only play one note at a time, and it passes through time horizontally. If you have an orchestra playing, you have a whole bunch of notes sounding simultaneously, harmonies, and that's the advantage of the piano. That's the way the piano is likened unto the orchestra. It can play at least 10 notes, 5 in each hand, simultaneously. So while it goes on horizontally, there is a vertical element involved. Now, if you only have 5 fingers instead of 10, you can only play basically half the number of notes simultaneously. So it becomes more of a horizontal experience rather than vertical. But Ravel was so artful in his manner of composition that he made it sound somehow as though both hands were playing simultaneously.
It must be an incredible workout, though, to get one hand up and down the keyboard.
Yeah, but also one of the challenges is balancing, because when you sit at the piano, you usually sit with a central point that you line up with your navel. You know, this is the middle of the keyboard, and now my hands are equally accessible to the ends of the keyboard. But with the left-hand concerto, you have to play with the left hand at the top of the keyboard as well as at the bottom of the keyboard. So your fulcrum, your center of balance changes, and the way you deal with it changes. Like sometimes when you play way, way up at the top, I have to hang on with my right hand, a luxury that was not available, unfortunately, to Mr. Wittgenstein. And maybe even stick out my left leg to counterbalance. I sometimes look like a crane in flight or something, or an ostrich standing on one leg.
My guest is pianist Leon Fleischer. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is pianist Leon Fleischer. Last year, your wife introduced you to a person who practices the technique of Rolfing. What exactly is Rolfing?
Oy, I'm not a doctor, but it is a way of dealing with, I guess the best description would be, deep massage in very, very slow motion. That deals with the connective tissue that surrounds the fibers of the muscles, of the tendons, of the tissues that lie under the skin. I think the premise is that as we go through life, we become more fixed and contracted in our posture, in our movements. Every little time we bump into a piece of furniture or something, that leaves an imprint, that leaves a mark on our tissue, on our fiber, and just alters a little bit our stance, our posture. And Rolfing returns us to a kind of symmetry, to a kind of balance that is inherent in the body, and that frees us up. In my case, it deals with helping decontract overworked muscles and tissue.
What was your reaction when she brought the whole idea up? Are you always game to try another remedy, or had you just had your fill of the whole alternative healing scene?
There were many times when I had had my fill, and I would get no end of suggestions, always well-meaning. To try this or try that, or I know this healer here, and there have been magnificent results with that person, or whatever. Actually, I had been Rolfed about 15 years ago. Since then, it has become far more flexible and far more applicational, if I can use that word. They are willing and do attack specific problems and stay with those problems.
And did your fingers, your hand respond very quickly?
Slowly. I think this is not a bad, if one can extract lessons and give advice from these experiences, one needs patience. It takes time. The body is extremely willing, if not eager, to recover its balance, to heal itself, but it does take time.
You played a two-handed repertoire with a few symphonies last summer, and the concerts were a bit of a surprise attack. One was at Tanglewood last August. The audience didn't know you would play with both hands until they read their programs, and I just imagine it must have been very suspenseful for them, that everyone in the whole place must have been on pins and needles thinking, oh, dear God, I wonder if Leon's right hand is going to hold up.
Yeah.
How do you react to the fact that this hand issue is a bit distracting?
Well, I was certainly among them wondering how my right hand would hold up. Actually, you make it a little more dramatic than it was. I had decided to do it, and they did announce it, I think, a week or two before the performance, but they announced it without any fanfare. They just, said that I would be playing, and I would be playing a Mozart concerto, 414 A major, and that was it, so that they tried to keep the outside pressures to a minimum, for which I am enormously grateful. We did have rehearsal. We had two rehearsals, and I still haven't quite figured out. For example, when is the optimum time for me to have a Rolfing treatment before a performance or before the rehearsals for a performance? Or should I have one between first and second rehearsal or between second rehearsal and performance, or should I not? These are things I'm still finding out. It's fascinating. It's a real adventure for me.
You sound more like an athlete, a professional athlete, than a musician.
How perceptive. I think that if the money were sunk into musicians, that is, sunk into professional athletics, this problem might have been resolved, not just for me, but it is a widespread problem amongst instrumentalists. I think it would have been solved long ago. Simply because, for example, what does a pitcher do after a game? What is the first thing that he does? He goes and sticks his arm into a tub of ice to decontract, to decongest the area that has become contracted and congested with all that throwing. The other point is that we use small intrinsic muscles in our hands. Football players probably, using the large muscles of the body, can get away with that macho image of playing through pain. But if you have pain in the hand or in the arm where the muscles are much smaller and much more vulnerable, much more delicate, as it were, than your massive leg muscles, the pain is the first sign: stop, stop, stop. Something is wrong. Do not try to play through it. And I, unfortunately, grew up in an age when playing through pain was kind of the macho thing to do.
What do you do after playing? Do you put your hands on ice?
No, I stretch now. I stretch before I play, and I stretch right after I play. Because working a muscle is contracting it. And as, you know, kids work 4, 5, 6, 7 hours a day, they've worked that muscle for those many hours, and that muscle is a little bit, is contracted considerably. There's a buildup of lactic acid that has to flow out, has to get out of the muscles before it can be used again. But every day, and we work 7 days a week and 52 weeks a year and 30 years, every day, if you don't decontract those muscles, every day you start from a point a little more contracted than the previous day. And this builds up over the years until finally you have muscles that are like petrified wood in your arm.
Now that you're playing with both hands again, do you still feel a great affection for the left-handed repertoire? I would imagine by now it's your baby.
In a sense, yes. Oh, I'm not going to relinquish that. I'm not going to give it up. I will continue. From time, I'll try and combine them on programs and things like that. But some of it's very good and should be played.
Leon Fleischer, thank you very much for talking with me on Fresh Air.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Pianist, conductor, and professor of music, Leon Fleischer.